19. Here we see God reveals himself in two ways to mankind. First, he reveals himself through his creation. Psalm 19 and verse 1. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. So we can see God in the beautiful creation around us, in the universe, in the biological creation. And some people, even some members of my family, think, well, we can just commune with God in nature. Well, the problem is God uses nature to point back to the other way that he has revealed himself to us, and that is through his word. He has revealed his mind to us. Verse 7, the law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. And the fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. God has revealed himself, his mind to us in his word so that we can know how to live. And if there's someone here tonight, and I would guess that there is, with a crowd like we have, with young people, who have not named the name of Christ, tonight we're going to have an invitation at the end of the second lesson. And I would like for you to consider your relationship with the Lord and consider what would happen if you died tonight. Would you be prepared to meet God in the judgment? Thank you for inviting me to this series this weekend. I hope that I can live up to the expectations that are that you have. And I will start out by saying something. I'll parrot what one of my, I consider, mentors says when he begins speaking. Normally from this pulpit, you hear gospel preaching. But tonight, we're going to focus on science, and we're going to respond to a false doctrine, an error that has destroyed the souls of many young people and old people alike, and that is neo-Darwinian evolution. The first lesson will be on the fact that it is unscientific. I will point out we have some materials in the front, and this weekend we're only going to give you a thumbnail sketch, just the tip of the iceberg of apologetics, creation science, intelligent design, in response to the doctrine of evolution. But I would like for you to introduce yourself to a lot of these materials that would be very helpful for you. I'll recommend a couple of books that I think all young people should have when they go off to the university. Well, where does our faith come from? The faith of the creationist starts in Genesis, the first chapter, in verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. For the naturalistic evolutionist, their faith is quite different. Their faith starts 13.8 billion years ago, when all the mass and all the energy of the universe was compacted into a singularity, smaller than a period at the end of the sentence. A sentence. And then one day, this period decided to explode and created all the great design and the beauty and even the scientific laws in the universe. That's what we are told. Then 4.54 billion years ago, the Earth was created. 3.8 billion years ago, the first life form appeared. And then finally, at the very end, dinosaurs appeared 245 million years ago. And finally, humans came on the scene just 100 to 200,000 years ago. That is the doctrine that we're going to be opposing this weekend. And on Sunday morning, we're going to have a lesson on the 6 days of creation. Now, let's justify what we're doing this weekend, first of all. Why a series like this? Well, first of all, God confronts numerous false doctrines, doesn't he? Gnosticism, Stoicism, the doctrine of the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the false gods of Molech, Chemosh, and Baal, the pagan idolatrous religions of the Moabites, Amalekites, and Hittites. Well, today we have to look around us and ask, what type of doctrines threaten us today? When I was in Texas on business a few years ago, I was in a Sunday morning Bible class, and an elder was teaching an excellent class on intelligent design and showing how the world around us reflects an intelligent designer and reflects God. And one man was a little perturbed, I think, with this lesson, thinking that it was straying from the Bible, and he spoke up and said, "Well, the Bible says the fool has said in his heart there is no God, and that's good enough for me." Well, a deacon in the back raised his hand and very kindly and softly said, "That may be good enough for most of us, but our young people are going off to the state universities, and their faith is being decimated. And unfortunately, that is the case." Why is that? Well, notice this quote from the atheistic journal Free Inquiry. A.J. Mathill says, "Evolution becomes the most potent weapon for destroying the Christian faith." And I can vouch to that, having heard story after story after story of young people that have lost their faith specifically because of the doctrine of evolution. I know of a young preacher in West Virginia. When I grew up there as a teenager, we used to go around to the small churches out in the valleys and the hills. And he was a very strong young man, and yet he went to the university, and among other things, he heard about evolution, and he became an atheist. Unfortunately, he's not an atheist anymore. 2 years ago, he took his own life, and now he knows there is a God. When I was in Indiana, number six here, some parents brought a homeschool child to me and said, "Can you help my child? He has lost his faith because he read about evolution on the internet." I know of a Christian college student in Oregon that went off to university. When he came back, they asked him to lead singing, and he said, "I can't lead singing anymore. I'm an atheist now." They said, "Why are you an atheist?" He said, "I learned about evolution, and I know there's no reason for God now." A man in South Carolina came up to me after a lesson, and with tears in his eyes, he said, "I've lost three of my children to this doctrine." Our neighbor in Pennsylvania was an atheist. And when we talked to him, he said he used to believe in God until in middle school he learned about evolution, that the world wasn't created, it just evolved, and he knew there was no reason for God. I also know of two young Christians from New Jersey at a university there who both lost their faith because of evolution. Well, I want to recommend a few books tonight. The first is the New Answers book series, 1-4, up front. These are the most commonly asked questions about evolution, apologetics, intelligent design, and creation science. I would encourage you to get copies of those. Now, there is a caveat. This is written from a denominational slant. Everything on creation and intelligent design, I think, is very accurate. But we beware of once saved, always saved, Calvinism, and premillennialism. The next book, which I have no reservations about at all, are these two books. If you want to just get one or two books on evolution, get these books by Jonathan Sarfati. Refuting Evolution 1, Refuting Evolution 2. It covers just about everything that you'll be taught in high school or college and refutes it. Well, let's get into the lesson. What's unscientific about evolution? First of all, the doctrine of abiogenesis. What is abiogenesis? Life coming from non-life, such as the first single-cell organism coming from a hydrothermal vent in the middle of the ocean. Well, what are the chances of life generating at random? We're told that life just spontaneously appeared in the ocean some 3.8 billion years ago. Well, I want you to consider proteins. Proteins are the workhorses of the cell. And to create proteins, you have to have building blocks called amino acids. Now, this first lesson is a little technical, but I'll try to keep you awake. Don't let your eyes glaze over. If you can make it through these first few points, everything else is downhill. But to create a protein, you need to have 20 amino acids, all 20 amino acids. So they say all 20 of these amino acids just spontaneously appeared in the ocean. You can think of it this way. The proteins are the house. The 20 amino acids are the bricks that build the house. Now, even if all 20 amino acids could have suddenly appeared in the ocean 3.8 billion years ago, they would have spontaneously disappeared. They would have been oxidized because the early oceans had oxygen that would have destroyed them. Well, let's grant that they weren't destroyed. The first protein would have had to been created by an enormous string of properly ordered amino acids. At least 267 of these. And they think that just happened by accident? Not only that, the first cell would have to have 300 proteins with 267 amino acids in each protein. This would be 80,100 amino acids arranged in the proper sequence. What are the chances of that? Beyond that, the first protein would have to be constructed with a tail that instructs the chain how to fold in on itself in the right three-dimensional shape, because all proteins have to be folded properly in order to work. Have you ever heard of mad cow disease or BSE? Those are just improperly folded proteins. For the first cell to appear, it would have to have the precise folding of the proteins to make them work. Well, beyond that, to fold the proteins, you actually have to have another protein called a chaperone. And the chaperonins have to, the protein is fed through the chaperonin and then it is folded. Beyond that, all 80,100 of these amino acids have to be left-handed and not right-handed. There's a chirality in which they are shaped, and so they would all have to be left-handed. Time fails us to talk about all the other mechanisms that they would have to have. RNA polymerase, transcription, photosynthesis. But think about this. Even if the first cell could spontaneously have occurred with 80,100 amino acids arranged in the proper sequence, it would have had to have been self-replicating, or it would have just disappeared. How would it reproduce itself? Well, not tomorrow night, but later tonight, we will further examine the chances of having the left-handed, right-handed chirality right for just 100 proteins. Point two, macroevolution is not scientifically testable or falsifiable. This means you have to be able to test it to determine whether it is true or false. Falsifiability is the logical possibility that an assertion can be shown to be false. If it can't be falsified, then it's always assumed to be true, and it's considered a question-begging fallacy. Macroevolution is a rigged philosophy. It's designed to prevent it from ever being disproven. It's a shell game. Notice what Theodosius Dobzhansky said. He's one of the architects of the modern synthesis of evolution. He says it is impossible to reproduce evolution of man. Experimental evolution deals with only the simplest levels of evolution, sometimes called microevolution or variation within a kind. Different kinds of dogs, different kinds of pigeons, different kinds of pigs, different kinds of cats, different kinds of cattle. They can vary within their kind, but not outside their kind. And I'll just point out, we're going to have to move fast, and so I have abbreviated some of these quotes with the blue words, but you can get the PowerPoints and read the rest later. Notice Drs. Ehrlich and Birch in Nature said, evolution cannot be refuted by any observations. It is thus outside empirical science. That is, you can't test it. But not necessarily false, no one can think of ways in which to test it. And why is that? Well, it's because neo-Darwinian evolution does not adhere to the four-tiered scientific method. How many of you have heard of the scientific method in school? You heard of the scientific method? Okay. That's the way we conduct operational science. That's the way you run experiments and come to valid conclusions. And it involves these four steps. First, an observation of some event in the universe. Second, a hypothesis to explain the event. Third, you have to design experiments to test the hypothesis. And then you have to conduct repeatable experiments. So it looks like this, hypothesis or observation, hypothesis, experiment, conclusion. Darwin, however, did not run experiments. He simply observed and came to the conclusion. Notice this. This is what Darwin did with the scientific method. He turned it on its head. He said, there's an observation. There's many different types of life forms in the world. His hypothesis is that they all came from a single-celled organism. And so he came to an a priori conclusion. That is, the conclusion precedes the experiments. He simply concluded, well, they must have all evolved from a single-celled organism, which is not valid science. Notice what Dr. L. Harrison Matthews said. He was honored with writing the foreword to Darwin's book on the Origin of Species. He said, in accepting evolution, how many biologists reflect that science is built upon experiments or remember that evolution has never been thus proved? Is it a science or a faith? Point number four. Now, here's the most technical point. If you can get through this, then you've got it made. What about radiometric dating? It all comes back to radiometric dating. In order for evolution to occur, the Earth has to be 4.5 billion years old, and you're always discussing the age of the Earth with people, and they'll go back to radiometric dating. Well, what is radiometric dating? First, I'll point out that 90% of tests used to determine the age of the Earth all determine a young Earth. It's only the 10% of the tests that assume, that are based on unprovable assumptions, that return an old age. Well, what are some of the tests that prove the Earth is young? The amount of salt in the ocean. There's not enough salt in the ocean for the oceans to be 4 billion years old. The amount of sediment in the ocean. There's not enough sediment in the ocean for the ocean to be 4.4 billion years old. In fact, 128 billion tons of sediment flows into the oceans every year. If the oceans were 4 billion years old, they would already be filled up with sediment. There are many other tests we can talk about later, but radiometric dating relies on radioisotopic decay. That is, there are elements that are unstable, and therefore they spit out these atomic particles. Have you ever seen on TV where they have a Geiger counter, and you hear click, 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 click? Well, that's these atoms coming apart and spitting out pieces from the parent to create the daughter. It actually takes one element and turns it into a second element. One place I presented this, someone said, you can't turn one element into another. You're just making that up. No, for those of you that studied this in school, you know that's true. Rubidium turns into strontium. Uranium turns into lead. Potassium turns into argon. Samarium turns into neodymium. And carbon-14 turns into nitrogen-14. And it works with half-lives. That is, how much time does it take for 50% of the element to disappear? Well, in the first half-life, you have half remaining. The second half-life, a quarter. Third half-life, 1/8. And the fourth half-life, 1/16. So if you have 1/16 of the parent and 15/16 of the daughter, how many half-lives do you have? Four. Then you multiply it by how much time it takes for a half-life. And so let's just give one example. For carbon-14 to decay to nitrogen-14, it takes about 5,700 years for the parent to go to the daughter element. And therefore, you measure the half-lives. The first half-life, it's 5,700 years. The second, 11,400. The third, 17,100. The fourth, 22,800. And so the different elements have different half-lives, and that's how really they measure they assume they measure the age of the universe. But there's a problem with that. They assume, and they've only been doing these tests for 100 years, but they assume that for 4.5 billion years ago, all these clocks have ticked at the same speed, which they haven't. We know that in the past, based on atmospheric conditions, redox potential, temperature, pressure, and Earth's magnetic field, the rates of radioisotopic decay have been different. This is verified in a study that was conducted over 11 years, and it took $1 million, and I have these two books up front, Thousands Not Billions in Radioisotopes and the Age of the Earth. However, you don't have to go to that study. Even in the 1970s, this was reported in the journal Industrial Research. Radioactivity is thus shown experimentally not to be an unalterable property of the atom. Half-lives are not constant, and that's based on pressure, temperature, chemical state, electrical potential, stress of monomolecular layers. Well, let's just go through these assumptions. There are 9 assumptions that they say they have to believe in order for radiometric dating to be true. First of all, by faith, evolutionists believe they know how much parent element was in the rock when it was formed. They can't know this. They can't know how much uranium was in the rock to begin with. They believe they know how much daughter element was in the rock. They can't know this. They believe that no parent element leaked into the rock and no parent element leaked out of the rock. That no daughter element leaked into the rock, no daughter element leaked out of the rock. And they also believe that the rate of radioactive decay has been the same for 4.5 billion years. This is known to be false by this quote that we saw. And they also believe that when magma is created, when we have lava, that it resets these radiometric clocks. That's not true. And they believe that all eight common methods of radiometric dating return the same ages, but they don't. Okay, that's all the technical stuff. Now let's get into the application. So in the Grand Canyon, at the top of the Grand Canyon, you have the Kaibab Plateau. And they say this is 250 million years old. But you have the Cardenas basalt, this lava that flowed over the top. Now, how old would that have to be? It would have to be less than 250 million years old. But in the book I showed you earlier, they tested. They took these samples from Cardenas basalt and sent it for radiometric dating. And look at the ages that came back. By the potassium-argon method, they said it was 516 million years old. Rubidium-strontium method, 1.1 billion years old. Samarium-neodymium method, 1.6 billion years old. When you use different methods, you get all sorts of different ages. Conventional geologic radiometric dating is wrong. And here are some old dates for some young rocks. The Hualalai basalt in Hawaii, it erupted in 1801. When they measured it, it returned 22.7 million years. The Rangitoto basalt, it's less than 800 years old. When they measured it, it returned 15 million years. The Mount Erebus basalt, when they tested it, it was less than 17 years old. It came back at 1.6 million years. Mount Etna basalt, it erupted in 1972. It came back as 0.7 billion years, or 700,000 years. Again, I'll point you to these books, and that concludes this first point. But this is just to say that the science isn't always right, as we're going to point out. I'd also point out this set that I have up front, radioactive and radiocarbon dating. Well, you may be asking, how could science be wrong? I have so much faith in science. Well, here's the point. Operational science is an accurate and extraordinarily powerful tool. And it's a gift from God. You know, the early scientists, the greatest scientists in the 15, 16, 1700s, all believed they were searching for the mind of God. They were searching for these laws that God created. But operational science is powerful when it follows the scientific method. But macroevolution does not follow the scientific method. It is a philosophy. Let me give you some examples of scientific ideas that have been overturned. In the 16th to the 18th century, we were told that California island theory, that California was just an island off the coast of Western North America, science was wrong. In 1600, science said the sun revolved around the earth. Science was wrong. In 1800, science treated illnesses by bleeding people, which probably killed the first president of our country. Science was wrong. And the last point here, in 1860, Charles Darwin said women and African races were evolutionarily and intellectually inferior to white men, according to evolution. Well, science was definitely wrong. You might say, I didn't know Charles Darwin was a sexist or a misogynist or a chauvinist. Well, what's the title? Notice the subtitle of his second book, The Descent of Man and Selection in Relation to Sex. He, in this book, taught that men were more evolutionarily advanced than women, especially in intellect. Well, what about his racism? You will not hear this taught in school, but Charles Darwin was a racist. Notice this quote from Descent of Man. At some future period, man will almost certainly exterminate and replace the savage races. The anthropomorphous apes, what's an anthropomorphism? making something that's non-human have human attributes. The anthropomorphous apes, or all these minority tribal peoples, will no doubt be exterminated. You might say, I was never taught that. I can't believe that. Well, notice what the subtitle of his first book is, Origin of Species, or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. In a letter in 1881, Charles Darwin said, at no very distant date, what an endless number of the lower races will have been eliminated by the higher civilized races throughout the world. Darwin taught that the African races descended from the strong but unintelligent gorillas, the Orientals from the orangutans, and very conveniently, the whites descended from the most intelligent of all, the chimpanzees. Well, Darwin's apostle in Germany, Ernst Haeckel, who tried to convince the German people that evolution was true, when after Darwin's book came out, the general public did not want to accept it. Notice the quote that he has in his book. I consider the Negro to be a lower species of man and cannot look upon him as a man, for the gorilla would have to be admitted into the family. So racism began to increase and grow in popularity amongst Caucasians after Darwin's book came out. Notice what even Stephen Jay Gould says, Harvard professor and rabid evolutionist. Arguments for racism may have been common before 1859, but they increased by orders of magnitude following the acceptance of evolutionary theory. And notice he also says the price of perfect design in evolution is messy, relentless slaughter. And I hate to show you these next few slides, but I think it's important. Slaughter they did. As a result of Darwin's teaching, Australian Aborigines specimens were in high demand to demonstrate that they were the missing link. Published documents proved that greater than 10,000 of Aborigines specimens were shipped to British museums. The Smithsonian Institute actually housed the remains of thousands of Aborigines. Notice this newspaper clipping from 1924, the New York Tribune. Kindred of Stone Age man discovered on the Antarctic island. Missing links with mankind in the early dawn of history. This was about the time of the Scopes Monkey Trial in 1925. Has anyone ever seen this movie, Inherit the Wind? Which is really a mockery of Christianity and a mockery of creation. Well, the textbook that they were using at this time during the Scopes Monkey Trial actually taught that the minority races, such as the Australian Aborigines, were more closely related to the apes than the Caucasians were. But you won't hear that taught in school. When there were only four remaining Aborigines on Tasmania, Darwin requested their skulls, provided that did not upset their feelings. Many museums wanted the skins of Aborigines or freshly killed specimens so they could be stuffed. Dr. Edward Ramsey, curator of the Australia Museum in Sydney, published a book on how to plug bullet holes. Ramsey also requested skulls of the Bunji Blacks, a tribe. 4 weeks later, a scientist sent him two corpses, proudly proclaiming the last of their tribe has just been shot. Unfortunately, that is the dark fruits of evolutionary theory in the 1860s and 1870s. Well, what are some other scientific hypotheses that have been overturned? 1940, they used lobotomies to treat the mentally ill, a barbaric practice. In the 1960s, if you went to school in the first half of the 1960s, you were probably taught the steady state theory of the universe, which has now been changed in the latter half of the 1960s to the Big Bang theory. Well, the Big Bang theory is full of problems. If you doubt that, just look on Wikipedia. They devote over 1,500 words to problems with the Big Bang. What are some other scientific hypotheses that have been overturned? 20th century eugenics to eradicate genetically inferior people in this country. People were forced sterilized in the 1920s and 30s in this country. And 21st century eugenics in America to eradicate genetically inferior people that will hopefully be overturned one day. You might say, well, what eugenics is going on today? Did you know that over 90% of Down syndrome diagnosed babies are all aborted because they would be a problem to care for? What about the scientific truth that all these drugs are safe? Fen-phen, fluoroquinolones, Vioxx, Darvocet, Avandia. These have led to heart valve destruction, ruptured tendons, heart disease, heart arrhythmias, and Avandia led to 83,000 heart attacks in 8 years. What's the point? The point, friends, is science can be wrong. Scientific hypotheses are overturned all the time. The Word of God will remain forever when all these hypotheses are shown to be wrong. Once again, operational science is accurate when it follows the scientific method, but evolution does not follow the scientific method. Then why has neo-Darwinian evolution been accepted? Well, first of all, I think it's the parroting effect, because we've been told we should believe in it, and so we parrot it. For the sake of conformity, we bow down to the bully pulpit of Darwin. In schools, we're forced to study this. In college, we're forced to recite it on tests. It's like sheep following other sheep off a cliff. I like this cartoon, follow the crowd, do what the other sheep do, child. Why can't you remember that? It's like the blind leading the blind. Notice what this man said who lived within the lifetime of Charles Darwin about evolution. How very few of the leaders in the field of science dare to tell the truth as to the state of their own minds. How many feel themselves forced in public to do lip service to a cult they do not believe in? Why else has Darwinian evolution been accepted? Because of a bias against divine creation. Because we can't believe that there is a God that created it. Listen to Richard Lewontin, Harvard professor. Materialism, that means the material world is all that exists, there's no spirit. Materialism is absolute. We cannot allow a divine foot in the door. Well, the last point in this first lesson, intellectuals and scholars from the highest tiers of science and medicine reject Darwinian evolution. Now, the point of this last point is to say, is to respond to the charge that's often made. Well, there are no credible scientists that doubt evolution. That's what you're going to be told in school. That's what you're going to be told in college. Well, there are. Some of the highest tiered scientists and physicians and surgeons doubt and deny evolution. This was pointed out in this movie, Expelled. Has anyone seen the movie Expelled? Just a few hands. You need to see this movie. In one place where I presented this, the young people took it home and looked at it on a Friday night. In this movie, they point out a number of scientists whose careers have been destroyed because they questioned evolution. Richard Sternberg, two PhDs. Dr. Carolyn Crocker, immunopharmacologist. Michael Egner, a neurosurgeon. Robert Marks, electrical and computer engineer. Guillermo Gonzalez, an astrophysicist. And then they make the charge, well, you can't understand biology unless you believe in evolution. You can't understand medicine unless you believe in evolution. Well, listen to Dr. Mark Kirschner, founding chair of the Department of Systems Biology in Harvard Medical School. He said, in fact, over the last 100 years, almost all of biology has proceeded independent of evolution, except evolutionary biology itself. Molecular biology, biochemistry, physiology have not taken evolution into account at all. I guess that puts that argument to rest. Well, let's look at 13 impactful scientists who've rejected neo-Darwinian evolution. Joseph Henry, he discovered self-inductance, and he was the first secretary of the Smithsonian Institute. He denied Darwin's theory. Louis Pasteur, who was a believer, a father of pasteurization, and he disproved spontaneous generation, which people still believe today. He denied Darwinian evolution. James Joule, father of thermodynamics. Any of you take physics and you use the unit, the joule? Well, this is what it was named after, James Joule. He denied Darwinian evolution. Joseph Lister, the father of antiseptic surgery. You ever heard of Listerine or the bacteria Listeria? And then Gregor Mendel. If ever there was an impactful scientist, it was Gregor Mendel. Whereas Darwin ran no experiments, Gregor Mendel ran a host of experiments using a copious number of trials He used, I believe, 28,000 pea plants to finally prove gene theory. And yet, because everyone was so caught up in Darwin's theory, his ideas were ignored for 35 or 40 years until they were rediscovered by Hugo de Vries in 1895. Some historians believe that Darwinian evolution held back biology and genetics for 35 to 40 years because they ignored the creationist Gregor Mendel's genetics. Other impactful scientists, James Irwin, the lunar module pilot on Apollo 15, George Washington Carver, the father of African American scientists, Wernher von Braun, the 20th century preeminent rocket scientist. Now, many people say, well, he was a Nazi. Well, actually, the Nazis threw him in prison because he didn't want to build V2 rockets to bomb London. He wanted to build a rocket to go to the moon, and eventually he accomplished that. And then there's Raymond Damadian, one I would like to point out. Raymond Damadian invented the MRI technology. The next time someone tells you no credible scientists doubt evolution, you should say, well, what about Raymond Damadian, who invented the MRI? There are 60 million MRI scans run every year. And he received the National Medal of Technology from Ronald Reagan in 1988. Notice what he says. I've been looking at the data for years, and I think evolutionists are just spinning their wheels. The argument that evolution occurred by chance has no foundation in reality. Theodosius Dobzhansky said, it would be wrong to say evolution has gained universal acceptance among biologists or geneticists. People who are not ignorant of the facts are anti-evolutionists. James Tour is one of the top 10 most cited chemists in the world who creates molecules from scratch. If you want to write his name down, he has some excellent videos on YouTube. He's also a believer. Michael Denton, he started the modern intelligent design movement based on his book, Evolution, A Theory in Crisis, in 1985. And the most well-known intelligent design author that some of you may be familiar with is Dr. Michael Behe. He wrote Darwin's Black Box and The Edge of Evolution. And he said, from Mivart to Margulis, there have always been respected scientists who have found Darwinism inadequate. Well, who are these people, Mivart and Margulis? Mivart was George Jackson Mivart. He was an MD and a PhD biologist. He denied Darwinian evolution. And what were Darwin's credentials? Not that you have to have credentials to argue the truth, but we're told this great scientific idea came from this great scientist, Charles Darwin. He had his bachelor's in divinity. We were expected to believe him and not the MD, PhD biologist. Who is Margulis? Margulis is Lynn Margulis. She was the ex-wife of the late Carl Sagan, who some of you will be familiar with from the 1980s and 70s. She said that neo-Darwinism will one day be viewed as a minor 20th century religious sect. Neo-Darwinism is a complete funk. We'll cover her later, but she believes that evolution happened by a different mechanism. She just says everything we're taught in school is wrong. And then there's this dissent from Darwin list. This is a petition that began in 2001. In order to sign the petition, you had to have your PhD in a relevant field or have an MD and also be a professor. Currently signed by 1,004 people who doubt and who deny Darwinian evolution. So the next time someone says, well, there's no scientists that doubt evolution, you need to ask them, well, what about all the scientists from all 8 Ivy League schools, from Stanford, Duke, Rice, Emory, on and on and on? Yes, there are credible scientists who doubt and deny evolution. There are 75 signers from Texas alone, from all of these universities. And then there are the surgeons and the physicians. Did you know that in around 2009, or let's see here, around 2006, they did a poll, and 60% of all physicians said that they doubt Darwinian evolution. You don't need to believe evolution in order to do science or medicine. And so they had this second petition that began in 2004. Physicians that dissent from Darwin. And there were 868 signers. In most states I go to, I try to look up some of these people and point them out. Here are some physicians from Missouri. Dr. David Hobson, a pathologist from St. Charles, Missouri. And Dr. Eddie Rundy, occupational medicine, Columbia, Missouri. Previously senior naval medical flight surgeon. Does anyone here know Eddie Rundy? Okay, when I was in Richmond, they said that he's actually a brother in Christ. But he signed this document. And so finally, in conclusion, let's conclude with a couple of quotes. And let me bring you up to speed to understand what's being said here. In the 1970s, there was a flurry of debates between evolutionists and creationists. And the creationists handily beat the evolutionists in the debates. In fact, in all the debates I've seen and read, I haven't seen one where I believe the evolutionists came out on top. And so, by 1980, Earl Hansen said this, "Why do creationists seem to be the consistent winners in public debates with evolutionists? We biologists are our own worst enemies in the creationist-evolutionist controversy. We must no longer duck this. Go out there and get them, boys," is what he said. Well, let's fast forward 16 years. There were even more debates in the 1980s and 1990s. And then Eugenie Scott said this. She's the director of the National Center for Science Education. You'll see her picture in her interview sometime. This is actually the center that it is the most well-known organization that promotes evolutionary teaching in schools and tries to prevent intelligent design from getting in schools. It should be called the National Center for Evolution Education. But by 1996, notice what she said. Avoid debates. Your campus Christian fellowship asks you to defend evolution. Decline. Public debates rarely change many minds. What does she mean there? It rarely changes the evolutionist or the creationist mind. Many evolutionists have been converted over to creationism through these debates. She said, "Have you ever watched the Harlem Globetrotters play the Washington Federals?" I think she means the Washington Generals. "The Federals get off some good shots, but who remembers them? The purpose of the game is to see the Globetrotters beat the other team, and you will probably get beaten." And I would recommend to you that you go online and look at some of these debates. Some of them are held in a very high regard or a high standard, a very high manner. And so it's not the wrangling that you might assume. And then we'll conclude with this cartoon that I like. The 6 days, creation days, Genesis, isn't important to Scripture. I'll just take the 6 days right out of my Bible. But if he pulls this miracle out and he's consistent, then he'll start pulling other miracles out and tear the Bible to shreds. And so we'll cover this on Sunday morning. "For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, and on the seventh he rested." I'd recommend these book sites, these websites. I recommend that you bookmark these, and it will help answer many of your questions. That concludes the first lecture for tonight. Thank you for your attention.
Maybe a 10-minute break.